Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game.
I played, and I chose to play, and I felt like the rewards were greater than the risks. But it's always more difficult to step back when you're a parent and say, well, I believe that same thing for my kids.
Former NFL quarterback Kurt Warner was criticized this week for his comments about football safety. Ahead on Only a Game, the one-time Super Bowl MVP explains his position, also a plan for reducing brain injury, and the current fight for the brains that could yield clues for injury prevention. Also ahead, Nicaraguan baseball and former San Francisco Warrior and current commencement speaker Tom Mascheri discusses his life in pro basketball and his poetry. Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. After his family and friends said goodbye at a private ceremony yesterday morning, fans and the city of San Diego got their chance to remember Junior Seau last night at a free public memorial at Qualcomm Stadium. But as Only a Game's Karen Given reports, Seau's death has exposed a struggle in the community of scientists dedicated to learning more about concussions and sports.
Let's start with what we don't know. We don't know if Junior Seau suffered from chronic traumatic encephalopathy, a disease that causes depression, mood swings, and erratic behavior in those who have suffered multiple concussions. We don't even know for sure if Seau suffered from multiple concussions. His ex-wife thinks there might have been many. A former teammate guesses as many as 1,500. If Seau's family allows his brain to be studied, as some organizations are reporting they have, we don't know what the results will be, or if the family will even choose to share the results with the public. But we do know that for the past week and a half, Junior Seau's family has been faced with these questions: whether or not to donate his brain to science, and which research organization should receive the gift. Things were simpler in 2002 when Mike Webster died of heart disease and other complications, and Dr. Bennett Amalu, the forensic pathologist performing the 17-year NFL veteran's autopsy, asked if he could look further into what may have caused Webster's trouble late in life. Webster's son Garrett says his family didn't hesitate.
Really, with all honesty, when Dr. Amalu said that he wanted to research the brain more, we kind of didn't give it a second thought, just simply because we were so, you know, wrapped up in grief and so wrapped up in the other things that were going on.
When Dr. Amalu found evidence of CTE in Mike Webster's brain, it was the first time a physical cause for what was then known as gridiron dementia had been found. Webster's family took comfort from the news.
It was definitely something that finally gave us peace that, you know, those times that, you know, Dad struggled, or those times that Dad maybe yelled at us, or those times Dad were depressed, it wasn't something we did. And when we found out what was happening, it made us feel better.
Now, Garrett Webster asks other families to donate to the Brain Injury Research Center, the West Virginia Institute where Amalu and other doctors study the long-term effects of concussions. But Webster's phone call is not the only one a family is likely to receive. Chris Nowinski, the co-director for the Boston University Center for the Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy, has said in the past that he's placed hundreds of calls to family members within 48 hours of a loved one's death, asking them to donate to a brain bank in Massachusetts. Garrett Webster says the most important thing is that the research be done by someone, but he acknowledges that he's in competition for brains of deceased athletes.
We believe our doctors are the best. You know, we were the people who discovered the disease. We've looked at more brains than anybody else. We are a 100% independent organization. We do not have accept any money from the NFL or any other professional sports league. So, of course, we're going to feel like we're the quote-unquote best, or we're the best option for people.
Boston University declined to comment for the story, saying, quote, "It is our policy not to discuss any completed, ongoing, or potential research cases unless at the specific request of family members. Our primary goal is to learn more about the long-term effects of repetitive brain trauma by conducting meaningful scientific research." The Boston University Center does list the National Football League and the NFL Players Association among its sponsors, something that Dr. Art Kaplan, the outgoing director at the University of Pennsylvania's Center for Bioethics, says isn't ideal.
One has to at least raise both eyebrows when research is funded, if you will, by someone that has a direct interest. In ethics, we call that a conflict of bias, and it means that because you have a dog in the fight, you have an outcome that perhaps could be skewed if you're funding the research as well.
Dr. Kaplan says families need to weigh potential bias and other factors. When faced with an unexpected or sudden death, it's not the easiest thing to do. Kaplan suggests an advocate could help families and survivors navigate the complicated issues surrounding donation of a resource that is in incredibly high demand.
The study of the brain has always been characterized by competition. There are relatively few people from all walks of life who donate their brains upon death. There are many people in the scientific community who would like to analyze brains for all sorts of reasons.
As deaths like Seau's bring more public attention to the issue, that demand is only going to grow. Suddenly, grant money is flowing and everyone is an expert. Even a 15-year-old high schooler was recently awarded $25,000 for developing a cheaper way to monitor big hits. It's a phenomenon about which Dr. David Hovda, director of the UCLA Brain Injury Research Center, has a good sense of humor.
I was asked by a colleague of mine up in Canada how many traumatic brain injury specialists there were in the United States. And I said, well, 10, 15 years ago, there was probably 200 of us in the United States. Now I think there are probably 20,000 of us.
Dr. Hovda says until recently, the only brain bank for traumatic brain injury resided in Glasgow, Scotland. Now he says the United States needs a collection of brain banks or data centers where specimens and the knowledge that comes from them will not become proprietary. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
None of us want to end football. None of us even want to change football. We just want to make it safer.
As if in response to Garrett Webster's assertion, people have begun to discuss what, if anything, the National Football League can do to make the game safer. I'm joined by sporting news writer Clifton Brown, who has written about what he thinks the league can do right now in order to accomplish that. Mr. Brown, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
In one of the dramatic lines in your recent sporting news article, retired cornerback Lem Barney says of the helmets that he wore during his long career, quote, "You can buy better helmets today at Walmart." Do you feel better equipment can prevent concussions?
I think the possibility certainly exists. There's a lot of research going on now on how to better design helmets so that when players take hits to the head, the helmet can better absorb the hit and keep the damage away from the brain. Because certainly if you could make helmets safer, then you wouldn't have to consider making maybe as many changes to the way the game is played if you could take some of the impact out of the collisions.
In that article to which I referred, which presents a few things that could be done immediately to increase player safety, you suggest that there should be, quote, an independent neurologist on the field to evaluate players and that the neurologist should have the authority to remove a player from the game if he felt that was necessary. Why hasn't that happened already?
There are some within the league who don't feel that this would make a major difference, that the people that they have evaluating players now know the players well, that they're best equipped to make these evaluations. But I think it needs to be taken out of teams' hands completely. Mm-hmm. I think that there's always the pressure if you work for a team, knowing that the team probably wants this player to go back into the game. I think that should not be a factor in this at all. It should be someone completely divorced from either team evaluating players and making strictly a medical determination of whether they need to go back into the game or not.
Before last season, the league moved kickoffs from the 30-yard line to the 35-yard line in order to minimize concussions. Did that help?
According to the league's data, it did. Certainly, there were fewer kickoff returns, period, because there were more touchbacks. So that lessened the amount of times where you had these full collisions with players running at full speed for 30, 40, 50 yards or so. It seems that a lot of the catastrophic injuries we've seen with not only head injuries, but with spinal cord injuries have occurred on kickoffs where players are running at full speed and have gained momentum for 30 or 40 yards and then have head-on collisions. So there was a reduction in that.
Is there an appetite, as Giants owner Tom Mara has suggested, for eliminating kickoffs altogether?
I think there are some people who would consider that a good move if the head trauma situations continue and that the concern for player safety grows, that more and more people may take that view. I think a lot of coaches and players are totally against that. Players who excel in that area of the game don't want that area of the game to go away.
What other changes to the rules or to the schedule would make sense to you?
Well, I think that now the talk about the NFL going to an 18-game schedule is going to be really hard to sell. There was already a lot of concern among players that adding two more games to the schedule would lead to more injuries. I don't think we're going to see an 18-game schedule in the NFL.
Football will always likely be a violent game, but will the sport still appeal to fans if it's adjusted to be made less violent and less damaging for players?
That's a great question, and I think there's a danger that football will become less popular if you take a large percentage of the violence out of the game, because I think that there's going to be a rebellion from fans, from the league, and from players to water down what they would say, water down the sport to where it's a game that people don't want to watch. People don't want to watch flag football on Sunday. They want to watch tackle football. So, yeah, there is the danger that if the NFL has to make too many rule changes to protect players, that it may become a less popular sport.
The suicide of Junior Seau has not yet been scientifically linked to damage he sustained playing football, and yet his death is already being called a tipping point for consideration of the future of the sport. Will the appetite to question the fundamental essence of football last beyond the headlines about Seau's death and funeral and memorial?
This isn't going to go away. Certainly something like that happening to Junior Seau, a guy who was so good as a football player, so respected as a person, and so young to take his life, really sent shockwaves through everyone connected to the sport. But just because, you know, as time passes and, you know, his death begins to become more of a fading memory, that is not going to make this issue go away.
Clifton Brown writes for The Sporting News. Among his recent articles is one titled, NFL Concussion Conundrum, Can Safety and Violence Coexist? Clifton, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Stay tuned to Only a Game for a conversation with former NFL quarterback Kurt Warner about the concern he has for the on-field safety of his own children. It's 19 minutes past the hour. There are lots of ways to have fun at a soccer game. You can cheer for your team, of course, and if you're a fan of Hartlepool United, you can dress in white overalls, a blue top, a white beard, a blue face, and a white cap. And then you can travel to the game on the London Underground with a great many other Smurfs dressed just like you. Neil Cooper, Hartlepool's manager, was delighted by the Smurfs, who filled most of a section in the stands at Charlton, where last Saturday's match was held. I got a message on my phone that said the Smurfs are invading Charlton, said Cooper. It was from someone in Scotland. The support on that day was brilliant. Unhappily, the Smurf support was insufficient as far as the game itself was concerned. Hartlepool United dropped the contest 3-2. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, a conversation with modern-day warrior poet Tom Mascheri. That's warrior, as in San Francisco warrior. He played with Wilt. But first, joining me now to discuss his recent comments regarding the issue of football safety is NFL Network analyst Kurt Warner, who was an NFL quarterback from 1998 to 2009. He led the St. Louis Rams to victory in Super Bowl 34, and he was the MVP in that game. Kurt, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much. Great to be on.
Last week, you said you were, I'm quoting, scared by the prospect of your children playing football. What in particular scares you about that?
Well, I just think that having played the game as long as I have and coming to understand how big and fast and strong and violent the game is, you know, we're starting to see some ramifications with certain individuals on a long playing career. It's one of those things that I played and I chose to play, and I felt like the rewards were greater than the risks in my situation. But it's always more difficult to step back when you're a parent and always say, well, I believe that same thing for my kids. I believe that, you know, the rewards are greater than the risks. And it scares me to think about the possibilities, the injuries that I see from youth football all the way up to the NFL. And doesn't mean my kids don't play. My kids have played and continue to play. But it's something that I worry about. I worry about what my next 20 years will look like. I worry about the hits that I took, you know, over the last 30 years playing football. And I worry if my kids continue to play, what that could mean for them.
Former New York Giants receiver Amani Toomer criticized you for, I'm quoting again, trashing the game. Do you think his attitude is representative?
You know, I think there's a number of people that view it that way. I think there's a number of people that view it saying that you have to be on one side of the fence or the other. Hmm. You either love the game and you know, never speak of the concerns or the issues that are there, or you're on the other side and you just want to trash the game and destroy it. And I disagree with that. You know, it's a game that's been tremendously good for me and my family. But at the same time, I think as an analyst and as a person that's played, that it's important and it's our responsibility to also share the concerns. So to think that I don't love the game and I'm trashing the game is crazy. To think that having concerns is bashing your game or throwing your game under the bus, to me, it doesn't make sense.
More and more current and former NFL players have donated their brains for research. Forgive me if the following question is too personal, but have you considered donating yours?
I have not done that. You know, I think the one difference with me in my position, because I think if you look at different positions in the NFL, the biggest issue, in my opinion, are those positions like linebacker, offense and defensive line, guys that are hitting on every snap and having that head trauma on every snap where these guys will suffer a concussion and then they continue to play. You know, so I haven't chosen to do that yet, you know, at this point in my life, but I'm interested to see some of the findings that they have with the guys that have.
It's interesting that you mentioned players at different positions perhaps being more susceptible to this kind of damage, because one of the more prominent players who's spoken about his deterioration is Jim McMahon, who, of course, was a quarterback.
Yeah, well, and again, I don't want to say that it is limited to those positions. I just believe that guys that suffer those injuries and continue to play through them and continue to get banged, you know, in that area are the ones that they believe can have the more severe long-term issues. And so it's those positions where you're continually being hit. And that doesn't mean a quarterback position can't suffer concussion and can't continually be hit, because we know that happens. But that, to me, in my opinion, like when I suffered concussions, it was very difficult for me to continue to play. So I was out of the game and wasn't subjected to continual hits within that game or within that time frame.
Football will likely always be a violent game, but will the sport still appeal to fans if it is made less violent and less damaging to players?
I believe so. I mean, I believe that it's a great game for a lot of reasons outside of the violence. You know, having 11 guys having to come together, you know, with the skilled players that you have, with the speed that you have of the game, the nuances of the game, I don't think there's any question. I mean, you know, of course I don't want to see it become flag football, but I think if you came out and had these great athletes playing flag football, people would watch, because these guys are so special and so rare and so talented, so unique in what they do, that people will still tune in. So I think that, yeah, you can make changes to this game and it can still stay the number one sport in our country.
We're talking about these issues, of course, in part because of the suicide of Junior Seau. When that has faded into the past to some extent, do you see this issue going away, or will people continue to address it?
I don't see it going away. I think the commissioner has done a great job in his time in that position of showing how important this is to him, how player safety and protecting that, you know, the greatest commodity of our game is very important to him. But I think the right things are being done at the NFL level. I just think we need to continue to work to do better at the NFL level, but also to trickle that down to other levels so we can start this prevention and this protection at a very young age, because, you know, you can even see these injuries and these effects start with kids at younger ages. And so there's concerns, whether it be players, former players, or individuals like myself that are parents of kids that are playing the game. I think all of those will continue to keep this in the forefront and push people to continue to explore different options of how we can do better and protect those plants.
Former quarterback Kurt Warner is an analyst for the NFL Network, and along with his wife, Brenda, he founded the First Things First Foundation. Kurt, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You bet. My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
All over the country these days, commencement speakers are trying to figure out how to advise and entertain members of the class of 2012. Very few of them played 11 seasons in the NBA, but Tom Mascheri, who'll be the graduation speaker at St. Mary's College of California a week from today, can claim that distinction. Here's Mascheri playing in Game 4 of the 1964 NBA Finals.
The Warriors now with Gary Phillips and Guy Rogers playing the backcourt up front of Mascheri, Chamberlain, and Thurmond. That's Rogers, number 5. Shot by Mascheri. 84-75. Boston's lead cut to 9.
Mascheri averaged over 12 points and 8 rebounds per game over his 10-year pro career. He was named to the 1963 NBA All-Star team, and he's a 1961 graduate of St. Mary's. Tom, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
You played before excited and vocal fans of the Golden State Warriors and the Seattle Supersonics from 1961 through 1971, so there must have been pressure on some of those nights, if not all of them. So, any nerves as you prepare to address the graduates at St. Mary's?
I think I'm probably more nervous about this commencement address than I could possibly remember ever being, playing basketball.
The year before you retired from the NBA, you published a book of poems, Over the Rim, and you have since published another one, Nothing We Lose Can Be Replaced. I wonder, will poetry figure in your commencement address?
It will indeed. And as a matter of fact, my third book of poetry just came out. I consider that my second book of poetry, because that first book of poetry, Over the Rim, was written when I really didn't know anything, frankly, Bill, about poetry. And I was just through playing basketball. I was trying to write something about my experience over the 10 years I'd played, and turned out to be pretty horrible poetry, as I found out later.
Well, so that our listeners can appreciate your poetry, and the one that I'm going to ask you to read is a long way from horrible. It's titled Willis Reed Center for the New York Knicks 1977 NBA Championship Team. Would you read that one for us?
You limped onto the court and made sports history. I limped to the kitchen for a beer, feeling this pain not in my leg, but in my heart. Only 2 years out of the league and already my body breaking down. A simple maneuver with the lawnmower, and I heard the muscle tear. No thanks to you, I'll probably hear somebody at work tomorrow say, "Look at Willis. Only one good wheel and able to outplay Wilt." Horse laughs, then the bright eyes of the dandelions staring from the lawn, daring me to return.
You know, as I speak with you, we hear so often about the difficulties that pro athletes have adjusting to life after basketball or baseball, whatever it might be. And it seems to me that you might be a fine choice to speak not only to college graduates, but to men graduating from the NBA, if graduating is the right word. What advice would you have for them?
I had a hell of a time getting out of the whole professional cocoon. I went to graduate school, and for about 5 or 6 years, I was You know, I was always doing something, but I was kind of a lost soul. I didn't know exactly where I wanted to focus my attention. And I think that's something that I could have helped myself with a great deal if in, for example, the last couple of years of my pro career, if I had been that insightful. But it wasn't until I actually got into teaching that I felt I found my second home. Hmm. I taught for 25 years in the city of Reno at Reno High.
Have you got another poem with you that you'd like to read?
I do. I wrote this poem for Wilt right after he died. None of us could imagine Wilt actually dying. I mean, guys 7 feet like that, an icon, you know, they don't die. Morning Wilt. This morning, I woke up thinking big. Time to crack a dozen eggs, fry all the bacon. I think I'll never shave. Let my beard grow as long as an epic. Dust off those books with thick spines. Gibbon's Rise and Fall, Gone with the Wind, the Summa Theologica. Spend the afternoon with Aquinas's 5 proofs for God's existence. The uncaused cause, or was it the divine plan that toppled Wilt? It might help reading about the prime mover, but I doubt it. Words are never enough. Let the day end as it began, with a red sun, and let there be a blonde soprano with big bosoms belting out her last aria.
Poet and former NBA player Tom Mascheri remembering his friend Wilt Chamberlain. I understand that you were among the first NBA players to be born in China. Yao Ming me no Yao Mings, right?
Absolutely, I was the first NBA player to be born in China. There's no doubt about that. I was born in Harbin, Manchuria, in 1938. And I also claim, since I was a naturalized citizen, I also claim to be the first Russian to ever play in the NBA. You know, Andrei Karolinko, eat your heart out.
So how did that come to be? You were born in China, but of Russian parentage.
I was. My parents were czarists. They lived in Russia prior to the revolution. Mm-hmm. The Reds came into power. They had to flee via the Trans-Siberian Railroad and settled in Harbin, northern Manchuria, China. And there was almost 200,000 what they call white Russians living in that particular city. When the Second World War broke out, everybody dispersed. There was a huge sort of diaspora of white Russians heading in all sorts of different directions. My mother, my sister, and I, unfortunately, were on our way to America to join my father, who had already arrived there 2 years previously, and we were captured by the Japanese and taken to a concentration camp in Japan. We didn't get out of that concentration camp till after the war was over, and then we came to the United States, joined my father in San Francisco.
Wow, that is quite a story, and makes NBA battles sound rather inconsequential in comparison.
Aside from Meta World Peace slugging you, I suppose. I guess that might be true. I love that name, World Peace.
I love the headlines that came out of it, you know, World Peace suspended. It was a terrible, terrible shame.
Oh, isn't that wonderful? I've always thought World Peace has been suspended for quite a while.
Tom Mascheri, poet and former NBA player and high school teacher, will deliver the commencement address at St. Mary's College next Saturday. Tom, good luck with the address, and I thank you very much for speaking with me. This was fun.
Thank you, Bill. Anytime.
You're listening to Only a Game. You can't please all the people all the time, or at least I can't, and Thomas Adams, who hears Only a Game on KUHF in Houston, wrote recently to express his dismay that we hadn't celebrated the achievement of San Antonio Spurs head coach Greg Popovich, recently named NBA Coach of the Year. Actually, our NBA analyst Henry Abbott of ESPN's True Hoop did praise the Spurs recently, and that accomplished team will surface again very soon in a story upon which Doug Tribou is working. Michael Farrell emailed recently to say he's irked at what he considers a double standard. He feels Only a Game is not an equal opportunity debunker, that we've been more prone to ridicule male athletes than female athletes or teams deserving of same. Paul Kearns sent an abbreviated message asking what happened to, that's the numeral two, college, high school, and amateur sports. You have too much NFL, NBA, and pro baseball. I hope he keeps listening for the story about kids playing baseball in Nicaragua. In response to our Derby Day program last week, William Anderson cranked up his iPad to ask, hey, what happened to that traditional local reporter? He had in mind Jenny Reese, the Louisville Courier-Journal racing writer who gives us the winner each May and hasn't missed in 19 years. For the record, though she didn't speak to us last week, she did correctly pick I'll Have Another. For sure. Absolutely. My recent commentary about baseball card collections, Lost or Tossed, helped Jim King come to terms with his experience along those lines. Under the commentary, as it was posted at onlyagame.org, Mr. King wrote, I was beginning to think I was the only one who had lost a shoebox full of baseball cards. I often wonder if they could still be in the attic of the house I once lived in. Probably not, but Last week's interview with rising chess champion Hikaru Nakamura provoked a great many comments. I mentioned that Mr. Nakamura is poised to overtake Bobby Fischer in terms of total points earned in tournament chess, thereby eliciting such responses as, that's expletive deleted, how can you dare compare mediocre Nakamura with genius Bobby Fischer, and Fischer's chess kill is weak by today's standards, and then there's my favorite somewhere toward the end of the rude skirmish, relax, dude, it's only a game. You, too, can respond to anything you hear on the program and other stuff at onlyagame.org as well by visiting the website. You can leave a comment on the listener line, 617-353-1860. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Trader Joe's, traveling the world to source a variety of foods and beverages like pizza from Italy and cheddar from Australia. Locations at TraderJoe's.com. This is NPR.
Chris Smart, who lives in Bishop's Gate near Eastleigh in Hampshire in Britain, can't afford a Ferrari, but he's a fine artist, Chris Smart is, so he painted a three-dimensional scene featuring a 1962 Ferrari 250 GTO on his garage door. Now, anybody driving by the place fairly quickly is likely to assume there's a Ferrari in residence. Chris should get in touch with Hans Legeter, an Austrian artist who also can't afford a Ferrari. Mr. Legeter used plastic and lightweight steel to surround his bicycle with the frame of a Ferrari FXX, or at least a facsimile thereof. People who see him coming think they're witnessing a really slow Ferrari. So what if Hans Legeter were to pedal his phony Ferrari FXX to Hampshire and then park it beside Chris Smart's garage? It would look like two Ferraris. That would be great. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, youngsters find a home on a Nicaraguan baseball field. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The second round of the NBA playoffs begins this weekend. The Celtics play the 76ers tonight, right down the street there in Game 1. Who do you like in that series?
I think the Celtics will handle the 76ers, although the 76ers are at this point playing with house money, having gotten extraordinarily lucky playing the Chicago Bulls without Derrick Rose. And then ultimately without Joakim Noah too, but it is like old times. I mean, this is a throwback to the golden days of both the '60s and the '80s.
I remember them well. Miami takes on Indiana tomorrow. Do the Pacers stand any chance in that one?
I think the Pacers stand a very good chance in this one. I think people have been sleeping on the Pacers all year, and I think if Miami decides to slow walk this thing and has one of those moments where they toss their resumes out on the court, they could be in big trouble.
In the West, the Lakers have struggled against the Nuggets. It certainly doesn't appear the Lakers will enjoy an easy path to the finals this year.
No, they got to play a Game 7 tonight. They've been erratic. Kobe Bryant is up and down, seems to have the flu, seems not to have the flu. And apparently, according to people in Denver, he's like the least popular opposing athlete in the history of Denver sports.
Tonight, the New York Rangers will host the Washington Capitals in Game 7 of the NHL's Eastern Conference Finals. Do you agree with the Rangers fans who say this series never should have gotten this far?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Rangers are a clearly superior team to the Capitals, but the Capitals have that one thing that we learned can take a team far in the NHL playoffs. They have the hot goalie,
yeah.
Exactly. Braden Holtby. I mean, the other night in Game 6, he faced 30 shots. Not a lot of them weren't testers, really. They were, you know, thrown in from the blue line. But he stood up to every challenge against the Bruins, and so far he stood up to every challenge the Rangers can throw at him. In a Game 7 with Alex Ovechkin back playing at the top of his form, I'm not willing to make a prediction on this one. I'm not willing to predict that the Rangers can win this game.
The Western Conference Finals will feature the number 8 seed, the LA Kings, and the Phoenix Coyotes. The Kings have now reached that level just twice in 45 years, and the Coyotes have never made it to the Conference Finals before, so which team is more likely to suffer from stage fright?
I have no idea, but that sound you're hearing are marketing people at the National Hockey League hurling themselves out the window in New York.
Weeping.
Because nobody knows anything. However, the Coyotes are probably boosted by the fact that somebody actually owns them now.
I understand that. For the first time in 3 years, they'll have an owner other than the National Hockey League.
Yeah, the league is going to sell the team to a group headed by the guy who used to own the San Jose Sharks, a guy named Greg Jamieson. So they are out from under receivership or whatever it is. I don't know if this will encourage the players to play well, knowing they'll have new bosses or not.
This week, former New Orleans Saints defensive end Anthony Hargrove said that he was disappointed that a document containing his acknowledgement that Greg Williams and Joe Vitt had asked him to play dumb about the team's bounty scheme was leaked. Is Mr. Hargrove being naive?
He's being extraordinarily naive. Once this thing started, there was no stopping it. People are covering their own hindquarters as best they can.
Chris Carter, late an All-Pro receiver with the Minnesota Vikings, acknowledged this week that he had created a so-called bounty arrangement of sorts, unless he didn't really, because it wasn't.
Well,
help!
Yeah, he said he would put out a contract on certain players who he thought were trying to injure him with his offensive linemen, and he said, I am guilty of bounties. It's the first time I've ever admitted it. I put a bounty on guys, and then said, well, maybe I shouldn't have used the word bounty, even though what he was doing was putting out a bounty.
The Vikings are on the brink of becoming beneficiaries of, quote, one of the largest subsidized projects in state history. Explain.
Yeah, they've managed to blackjack a stadium plan through that's going to cost almost $1 billion, half a billion of which will be paid by the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota, who are suckers for having done this, and I feel really terrible about them because they're never going to make a nickel of it back.
On Tuesday, Josh Hamilton of the Texas Rangers hit 4 home runs against the Orioles, which provoked discussion of whether he's the best player in the major leagues. You want to weigh in on that?
He certainly was the best player in the major leagues that night. I am astonished. You could have won a lot of money. Well, I couldn't have won a lot of money from me because I don't have a lot of money. But you could have won all the money in my pocket, all 85 cents of it, if you'd asked me if more people have hit 4 home runs than have thrown perfect games in the major leagues. The answer is no, that 21 people have thrown perfect games, and Josh Hamilton is only the 16th to hit 4 home runs.
On Thursday, the baseball team representing Our Lady of Sorrows forfeited rather than play Mesa Preparatory Academy in the Arizona Charter Athletic Association championship game because Mesa has a girl on the roster. She plays second base. This has got to be disappointing for many people, especially 15-year-old Paige Schultzbach.
Yeah, Paige has learned a very tough lesson about what happens when you hand a charter school over to people like the Society of St. Pius X, which is an ultramontane, conservative, some would say schismatic Catholic sect, which broke from the formal church in the 1980s and believes that the proper boundaries can only be respected with difficulties. One of the proper boundaries being apparently that their male baseball players can't play against female baseball players. I'm really sorry for Paige. I hope she learns that most Catholics aren't as intolerant as these people are.
I'm sorry for the kids on the team that forfeited, too, that he didn't get a chance to play.
I wonder how many of them have been taught it was the right thing to do.
Having lost most of his team to next month's NBA draft, Kentucky head coach John Calipari and his staff have worked very hard to secure the services of Nerlens Noel, the country's top prep recruit. How's that working out for him?
Well, it's been working out, you know, fairly well until the NCAA showed up at Everett High School, where Noel started, and he wound up at the Tilton School in New Hampshire, asking them, you know, what the principal at Everett said were not investigative-type questions. Nevertheless, this is like talking about an informal meeting with the IRS.
Right.
The NCAA does not ask any non-investigative-type questions.
I was going to say, what were they asking about, the weather?
We hear Nerlens is very tall. Can you confirm that? Why, yes, we can.
Yes, he's 6'10". Next question, please. Manchester City will very likely finish first in the Premiership by beating Queen's Park Rangers tomorrow.
Get right out of town.
I think it's fair to say that City's coach, Roberto Mancini, just couldn't be happier.
He's got himself a new £22 million contract, mm-hmm. which is almost as much as he would make for coaching, say, basketball at the University of Kentucky.
Kentucky, right.
Finally, Charlie cyclist Danny Lesh of Washington, D.C., recently had his $600 bike stolen. But
sports!
The resourceful Mr. Lesh hatched a brilliant plan to reclaim it. You want to take us through that plan?
I'd like to pause for a moment, Bill, and address myself to the thieves of the United States of America. Dear thieves, if you do manage to steal something from someone, don't put it up for resale on Craigslist, because the original owner may be on Craigslist and see it there. Danny Lesh had his bike stolen and was cruising around on Craigslist and found his bike.
There it is.
He was going to call the cops, but he said, aha, I have a better plan. He went to the guy, said, I want to buy this bike from you. The thief said, fine. Danny said, can I take it for a test drive? The thief, already proving that he was rather dim by putting the thing on Craigslist in the first place, said, sure, take it for a test drive. Off Danny went, and he never came back. Good for him.
I like the fact that the thief considered calling the police on Danny.
And subsequently, the thief, first of all, called him on the cell phone and threatened him, and then threatened to call the cops.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland. It's a Charlie's List of sorts, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Now get off my bike.
I've been caught stealing once when I was five. I enjoy stealing. It's just as simple as that. Well, it's just a simple fact. When I want something and I don't want to pay for it. Not now. Now walk right through the door. I walk right through the door. Hey, all right, if I get by. Hey, it's mine. Hey, watch it. Mine, all mine. Hey.
Baseball first arrived in Nicaragua in the late 19th century with a New Orleans retailer peddling bats and balls. The U.S. Marines helped spread the green gospel from the Caribbean to the Pacific when they occupied the country from 1912 to 1933, and despite America's support of the right-wing Contras during Nicaragua's 1980s Civil War, the Nicas still adore our national pastime. Nicaragua's wars are a distant memory today, and as Ken Shulman reports, kids there still dream of making it to the big leagues.
Okay, dos, tres,
the drill may be in Spanish, but the numbers are always the same. Three is first base, four is second in Toledo or Taipei, or here, in the shade of a grandstand in San Juan del Sur, Nicaragua, where local hero Alejandro Noguera walks 30 grade school students through the algebra of their national pastime.
Uno, dos.
Born and raised in this Pacific Coast town, Noguera played 15 years in the Nicaraguan major leagues and pitched for his country's national team. Today, the 34-year-old directs the local youth leagues, and twice a year, once in spring and once in fall, he runs this one-week after-school baseball camp. Each camp draws from a single grade school. Campers range in age from 6 to 13 and include both boys and girls. No one who wants to play is turned away.
We don't want anyone to feel excluded or feel frustrated. We want them to learn to say, I can. This is very important. We want all of them to say, I can do this. And once they say that, they have to say, I must. I can do this. I must do this. We want them to learn to be positive, to set goals and to meet them, because that's what you need to do in life.
The baseball camps are sponsored by the Christopher Shadigan Foundation in Burlington, Vermont, and the Eugene Brueger Fundación in San Juan del Sur. They're held at San Juan's Municipal Stadium. The field's a jewel, a finely combed diamond ringed by a crew-cut outfield lawn, all carved out of thick jungle brush contained gingerly by chicken wire. You can almost imagine a Nicaraguan shoeless Joe emerging from the palm trees beyond center field.
¿Quién está aquí porque le gusta el béisbol? Levanta la mano.
From the first baseline, Foundation Director Priscilla Orcuyo welcomes 30 students from the Azul y Blanco Elementary School. She asks them if they like baseball. They all raise their hands. She asks if there's anyone who doesn't like baseball. Several raise their hands again. Doesn't like baseball, she repeats, until they understand the question and lower their hands. The kids are a little nervous. It's their first day. Most of the nerves come from excitement. Baseball is el deporte rey in Nicaragua, the king of sports. It's said that Anastasio Somoza Sr., the dictator who rose to power here with American help, once called balls and strikes in Nicaragua's big leagues. But these kids don't know about America's interference, or even that baseball was invented in the U.S. And many adults old enough to remember both don't really care. Norberto Dilarte is a local merchant who plays on a regional team and helps at the baseball camp.
Yes, it's true. We haven't always had good relations with the U.S. government, but this is all politics, and it's all in the past. And these politics don't have any effect on the support we get from the United States for our sport, which is very strong.
Anti-Americanism may be history in much of Nicaragua, but poverty isn't. Despite improvements, Nicaragua remains the poorest country in the Americas after Haiti. The Field of Dreams that hosts the baseball camp is light years from this ragged scrap of pasture next to the Azul y Blanco school, where students play baseball during recess. Home plate here is a fragment of crumbling brick. Students slither through rusted barbed wire to retrieve foul balls, careful not to tear their white and blue school uniforms.
A veces un 20%, un 10%, según las posibilidades que sus padres tengan.
The students' life prospects aren't much more florid than the playing field. One teacher here estimates that fewer than 20% of the school's 60 students will go on to high school, less than half the national average.
No, la mayoría solo van al mar.
The majority of them will do what people here have always done, work as fishermen, in construction, or work the fields, struggling to feed their families.
A few, the lucky few, may find jobs in town as taxi drivers, waiters, or hotel maids. San Juan del Sur is a newly minted lodestone for surfers and global nomads looking for an edgy but safe third world adventure. Hotels in the center offer hot showers and high-speed internet. At night, travelers in beachfront restaurants chat in German, English, and French, while a Latin pop mix clashes with the live folk rock playing next door. MLB games unfold in pantomime across giant flat screens. The music's a little different a few kilometers away, here in the barrio of San Rafael del Valle. Maria Magdalena Gonzaga sells used clothes out of the three-room cinder block home she shares with her 9 children. She's thrilled that her daughter Soshari and son Lenin Jose were chosen for the baseball camp, thrilled for them and for herself.
My children aren't dying of hunger, thank God. But there are so many things I can't give them. They're always asking if they can play baseball, but they don't have shoes. At the camp, they have shoes. As a mother, I love it. They get to play. And I get a break from worrying about money and a break from this very stressful life.
A few doors down, Alvaro Navarro relaxes in the afternoon shade beneath his home's corrugated metal overhang. Navarro studied at the local university for 3 years before dropping out to support his family. Today he drives a taxi in town. 2 weeks ago, the teachers at Blanco y Azul asked his 9-year-old son, Jean, whether he wanted to participate in the baseball camp.
It's important that my children do more than I was able to do. To do this, we have to give them confidence, in school, at home, on the playing field. When my son was invited to join the baseball camp, he knew to say yes, because you don't ask yourself whether you want to when an opportunity comes your way, you just say yes.
For those who grew up with them, baseball and its numbers are strangely reassuring. 7 is left field, 8 is center, in Manila, Montreal, and Managua. But there are other numbers here in Nicaragua. 79.9, for example, the percent of the population that lives on $2 a day or less. Numbers that perhaps can't be revised by simply chanting 4 to 6 to 3.
Angelo, el pitcher que número es. Perfecto. Aplauso para Angelo.
For a few of these kids, the baseball camp may prove to be a turning point, the place where they learned the skills and focus they needed to forge ahead. For most of them, it's 5 days of fun in baseball, and nothing but 5 days of fun in baseball. But for all of them, this chance to play on a real field and be coached by a real professional will make a beautiful memory. And even in wealthy countries, beautiful memories aren't easy to come by.
Segunda base, número 4, perfecto.
For Only a Game, I'm Ken Schulman.
Cunas no hay,
no hay.
Que niño pobre tuvo cuna para nacer. Pero hay dinero,
sí.
Te lo presta el usurero, te lo presta el usurero.
Te lo presta el usurero pa' que el carpintero te haga el ataúd.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Parati. We had help this week from Amanda Art, Adam Ragusea, Rebecca Klein, and Peter Lydotes. Our intern is still Jeremy Conlin, we think. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Ken Schulman's Nicaraguan baseball photo gallery, please visit onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at onlyagameradio. Our final word this week comes from Alejandro Noguera and his students of baseball. Yes, one is pitcher and two is catcher, but 24, Willie Mays, of course. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from Valvoline, maker of next-gen motor oil, engine protection with oil made from 50% recycled stock. Learn more at Valvoline.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org. And the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. This is NPR.